Well, good day, ladies and gentlemen. This is Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik, and our website is redicecreations.com. Today, we're going to discuss the Newgrange Serious Mystery with James Swagger from Ireland. Some of the things we are going to discuss include passage grave cosmology, archaeoastronomy, archaeoacoustics, and also the relationship between megaliths and rock art, primarily in Ireland, but also in Western Europe, and the relationship to the stars and entopic imagery. Hi, James. Welcome to the program. Thank you for coming on, first of all.
Thank you, Henrik. It's a pleasure to be here.
You bet. This is going to be really interesting, fascinating stuff. I've been glued to your book in the last couple of days, and it's just amazing to me how much it connects with some of the things that we have up around in Sweden, in Denmark and Norway, of course. And I don't know, it just feels like there is a culture in our past which we're in communication and which shared knowledge. Who knows, there might even be one and the same race, if you will, behind all of this. We'll get into all of these details, of course, James. But why don't you just tell us a little bit first about your... It's always interesting to hear about the interest and how things got started for you and why you wanted to write the book, James.
Sure. I suppose I've always had a passion for megaliths, megalithic sites, megalithic regions. I've been in many places over my youth with my parents and through my working career in the last 10 years. But I mean, specifically, I have one key event, which was a bit of serendipity that kickstarted me into this research in an academic sense. But I guess I was growing up in school and we were always taught in Ireland and the UK, I've lived in both, and we were always taught, you know, these megaliths are silent. There's nothing to see here. Go home. They're just some stones. They're nicely arranged. They're very big, yes, but go home. There's nothing to see here. We can't figure this out anymore. It's a mystery and it's going to stay a mystery. And that's just not true anymore, Henrik. You know, we have the newfound subjects of archaeoastronomy and archaeoacoustics that have really opened up these monuments, you know. I never, even growing up with Hancock and Bovall and their great works and, you know, even on delving into archaeoastronomy, I never thought that I would be one day doing archaeoastronomy, especially not in Ireland. I thought if I would be doing it, I'd be doing it in Peru or Mexico or somewhere more dreamy than a little old Ireland.
Right.
But, I guess the thing is, you know, a lot of people are turning their eyes to these megaliths now and, they're not silent, and what happened for me was I got into archaeoastronomy as a subject when I had traveled to the UK, and in my early 20s I'd been working over there, and I spent about 12 years there, Henrik, in mainland Britain, Scotland right down to Cornwall, and I lived in a lot of megalithic regions, not by choice, just really that's where my career took me. And I mean, Wales, Scotland, Cornwall and England, you know, they all have their own dominant places for these megaliths. And, you know, I just happened to always seek these megaliths out. And most of the time, I'll admit, I just went to have a look, provoke my curiosity. It wasn't academic, and it's only been academic in the last, say, 5 years. But the key thing is that I was in all these regions. I mean, I've lived in the Outer Hebrides, and I've had the pleasure of seeing Callanish, Stone Temple, which many people don't go to because it's so difficult to get there, even by plane or boat. It's expensive as well, unless you're from the island. And, you know, it's just a place that's really forgotten about. It's seen in documentaries for sure. But so I was very privileged to get to these places. And I mean, having been away, I worked most of my life as a systems analyst, electrical engineer, mechanical engineering. I've had, you know, a very lucrative career. And I've worked on the world's first wind turbine. That's the big one, that is, not the small ones, in Denmark, in Western Denmark, in near Billund. I've also, you know, worked in the most complicated, most industrial complex in manufacturing site in the whole of Britain. And that was in the timber logging industry. And, you know, so complexities and problem solving was what I did for my career. And I found myself looking at these megaliths and having archaeoastronomy as a in the toolbox, if you want. But as a result, I decided to get a book called Hamlet's Mill by Hirsch von Deckend and Giorgio de Santillano. And for me, it's really the starting place. A lot of people that have wrote about archaeoastronomy really use that book as a starting point.
Yeah, like, they sure do.
Yeah, it's like the Archaeoastronomy Bible, Henrik.
Yep, yep.
And but the thing is, I could only get a rare copy of this book. And it came from America. It cost me I think it was 120 books at the time. And, you know, but, you know, I was dedicated and I wanted a copy of it. And that's the one I got. So when I do collect rare books, so it wasn't a big thing for me. But when it arrived, out of it popped a photocopy of this New Scientist magazine issue from 1976, July, the year and month I was born, which was, oh, right, that kind of drew my attention. And in it had an article. It was a photograph, a photocopy of an article of megalithic observatories. And in the article, it mentioned some rock art near where I was living, within like 5 miles in the north of Ireland. And the funny thing is, I mean, I get this book, a rare book that I didn't really want to expend that much money on, come from America, out pops this photocopy, and it's got some rock art that I didn't know about sitting right beside where I live. And I went, wow, huh. That means I got to go down and have a look at this. And when I went there, Henrik, I was just stunned, because this is like rock art clearly showing the constellations of Ursa Major and Ursa Minor. And this is what I write about in the book. I call this the Ardmore Equinox Stone, chapter 7 in the book. And I detail why this is important, because there is very few places in Ireland where you can immediately recognize constellation rock art. You know, there's many rock art that's open to interpretations of astronomy or consciousness or acoustics, or, you know, you can interpret art whatever way you want. That's fine. I mean, we'll get into some of that. But sometimes it's like readily recognizable as clear constellations. And not only that, we have two of them right beside each other, Ursa Major and Ursa Minor. And there's a clear notch on the top of the stone. So I thought this, oh, great, that's great. There must be something about it on the internet. And I went home and I couldn't find anything except for one thing. And the one article that I found was clearly erroneous. It was wrong to the core. The artwork was clearly distorted. Yes, there is other art on the stone, but the most dominant deep cups that this art is the most dominant art on the stone. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the stuff at the bottom that I didn't address. But the key thing for me was Ursa Major was clear, and it's so immediately recognizable to sailors. They use it to find the North Star. It's a very, very important constellation. And not only that, the brightest star of Ursa Major is denominated on the stone with clear concentric rings as well. So this was a no-brainer for me. And I was so stunned that this wasn't in the record, it wasn't documented. And that was really the driving force for me to get serious, because I seen something that wasn't documented, and I found myself in a place now. I found myself in a place where the rock art was kind of, I don't see it as decipherment, by the way, Henrik. I don't look at this as decipherment. I just look at this as recognizing it. You know, I don't, and you know, some people want to, you know, copyright the decipherment of rock art, and I don't really get that. Like, you know, I see something, I recognize it, I want to write about it, I want to talk about it. You can't copyright an alignment, and you can't copyright 5,000 year old rock art. Right. You know, that's the way. Right. But, you know, the other guy had done, and, you know, I mean, it's in the record and it's wrong. And I thought I would just go on this quest and journey to delve into this rock art with this newfound science of archaeoastronomy, but in a very serious academic way. Because I thought to myself, what else is wrong, or what else is waiting to be discovered? And in fairness, I thought it was all discovered. I thought it was all figured out. I would have been led to believe that my entire life. And that was wrong. And really, that was the key thing that got my serious academic hat on. But I guess the thing was then, you know, I already had a data bank of all these places that I had been to draw upon. So really, it wasn't just going back around and visiting all the places again. I targeted the passage graves, and I targeted the rock art for very two reasons. This is the key thing. I mean, passage graves have an alignment. There's a passageway aligned to something like a spring, autumn, or winter and summer solstice, these equinox and solstice. So that really tells you something what these guys were doing. There's some sort of a developmental thought pattern there, what these guys were trying to show us what they were doing. And there's also the rock art. So, you know, I'm lucky that I lived in Ireland. 45% of the rock art of the whole of Europe is sitting in a mile radius in Ireland. 1 mile radius. It's sitting in 1 mile radius location. That's jaw-dropping in itself, you know. So targeting the rock art and targeting the passage graves was a way to peer into the megalithic civilization, Henrik.
Fascinating. I mean, I want to talk more about the rock art, of course, the depictions and everything. You mentioned a couple of ones like the Ardmore, the Ogham Stone, I think it's been referred to as well. But nonetheless, I mean, there are some fantastic sites in Ireland. Some got to be one of the richest countries when it comes to megaliths. And this is, of course, a huge story that you've tied together, tons of different components to it. But much of it is centered around Newgrange, Noth, and Dothan there in the Boyne Valley at the River Boyne. So detail sure. that a little bit to us, what kind of site it is for people who've never been there or even seen a photo of this thing.
Sure, exactly. You know, and quite rightly, the books, the Newgrange Serious Mystery, I started in the book with Newgrange and I finished it with Newgrange. But really, the book is about passage grave cosmology, and I wanted to target the main passage graves. And so we have Newgrange, Noth, and Doth. They're all situated in one region called the Boyne Valley, which is home to about 40 megalithic tombs in total in various states of decay. And then there's another region in Carrollkeel. It's another what they call a megalithic cemetery, but it's a megalithic observatory complex as well, if you want to call it that. That's in Sligo. You have Loch Crewe. There's about 30 surviving in various states of decay. There was probably 100 there at one point. So Loch Crewe is another place that's just to the west of Newgrange, Noth, and Doth. So you have these various monuments across Ireland, but they actually are all situated in a straight line as well, as you look on the map, which is another anomaly. But going to Newgrange first, I mean, Newgrange is probably the most famous megalithic chamber, passage grave, but equally maybe Gavrinus in Brittany. Gavrinus is French for Goat's Island, I believe. And I've just been there again for the third time this year, and I've come back from there. And I think that's probably the most decorated passage grave. And it's on a par. I like to think of it, it's on a par with Newgrange. But Newgrange steals the show all the time, Henrik.
Right.
But equally in the Boyne Valley, you have 2 kilometers to the west and 2 kilometers to the east, you have Noth and Doth. And these are equally sized mounds. They are three monster mounds. Noth has the longest passageways of any passage grave in Europe, by the way. There's 2 passageways, one on the eastern side and one on the western side. I think something like 40 meters long on the eastern side, 36, something like that on the western side. And then you have Doth, which is unusual again. It seems to be older than Noth and Newgrange. And it's got 2 passageways that we know of sitting on the southwestern side of the mound. A lot of people speculate there's a hidden passageway on the other side of the mound where the important Pleiades stone, this rock art we're going to talk about later. But, so a lot of these may even have still passageways still waiting to be discovered. But what's so important about the Boyne Valley is, like I mentioned, it's dominated by rock art. It is absolutely dominated. Nearly every curbstone at Noth is decorated. and there's 2 types of art. Let me just say that there's astronomy based art, or astronomical calculations, if you will, from either constellations, moon calculations. A lot of it's open to interpretation, but you can see lunar counts of 19, and that kind of tells you, that the art is denominating either Metonic cycles or something like that. It's pretty much accepted as a lunar temple now. But again, you have Newgrange. It's famous for its entrance stone with the triple spiral. And Doth then has one pretty dominant piece of rock art, and it's the Pleiades, the 7 sisters. So these are extremely important passage graves in the whole scheme of passage graves because of the art associated with them. They're helping us figure out the intentions of the builders, it's very, 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 very important. But we're very, very privileged in Ireland to have these still surviving today. But I mean, you have Loch Crewe. For me, Loch Crewe is the real prize because it's little talked about, and it's got a lot of surviving. It's got a lot of surviving art there still. A lot of them are in various states of decay. A lot of roofs are caved in on some of the smaller cairns. Loch Crewe, there's 2 main cairns still there surviving today. And the acoustics inside are absolutely beautiful. But the good thing is that you can still go get the key and go up for private time inside these. And they're off the beaten track, Henrik. You get more personal communication with the monuments, if you will. You know, we're at Newgrange now. You've got like a quarter of a million people visit Newgrange a year. And when you when you understand the population of the Republic of Ireland is 3.5 million, you know, that's like a very large percentage of our population would go and visit Newgrange a year. And so they now rush people in and they rush them out, you know, and they'll take as many tours as they can squeeze in, you know, and it's like cattle herding in a way. They're just pushing in and out. And I understand that. That's great. I mean, we want to show these monuments off to the world. They're World Heritage Sites. You know, that's understandable. And but Loch Crew, again, you can go up there and spend as long as you want up there, really. And they only have tour guides up there for 2 months of the year. And they really are largely forgotten about. But, I mean, you can still go and watch the sunbeam come in on the spring and autumn equinox still today. And everybody gets a chance to see it. Whereas Newgrange, 25,000 people apply to for 30 places or something like
wow.
that.
You know? Yeah, exactly. You know, Is that really what's put Newgrange on the map? That's what makes it so special. But obviously what you're saying here is that this phenomena of the solstice alignment, and then you can see the light coming to the deep into the chambers, if you will, is also it takes place in Loch Crew.
Yeah, exactly. I know. And it also takes place in Doth as well.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Well, there you go.
But yeah, I mean, Newgrange, it happens on the winter solstice. I think if you're a politician, you have a better chance of getting in because they seem to hand out the rights to get into Newgrange to politicians very easy. A lot of people get very upset about that. But yeah, I mean, it's such a small amount of people can fit inside these monuments. Unlike Stonehenge, where there's mass gatherings every year, it's an open air event. Everybody can see the solstice. Everybody gets excited. But with Newgrange, you have to box people into a tiny little chamber. So, but on the same day that this happens, on the 21st of December at Newgrange, the winter solstice, you can go to Doth 2 miles later, or 2 miles down the road at 8 hours later in the day. And for sunset, you can watch the winter sunset enter into Doth, one of the passageways there. Hmm. And usually people get a chance to get in to see that. So yeah, and then you also have Loch Crew, Cairn T, it's called. They use this alphabetical naming system for these cairns. Newgrange has its own personal name, as does Noth and Doth, but when they don't have personal names, they usually give them an alphabetical letter. So you'd call it the Boyne Valley Complex, Cairn A, B, C, D, E, F, G, all
right.
like that.
Yeah.
And the same for Loch Crew. So, but Loch Crew, Cairn T, yes, you spring and autumn equinox, the sun still beam still comes in. And what's so beautiful about this is that you get a chance to see it. Like, I mean, not many people turn up for this, like, you know, and the ones that do are rewarded with a spectacular event, weather permitting. But
yeah,
but the beautiful thing is that it hits this rock art at the back of the chamber, and it hits one of these solar wheels, basically one of these circular segmented wheels. And the sunbeam traverses down at a 45 degree angle from the top left of the back stone to the bottom right. And it's another solar wheel. And then it finishes outside the back chamber on the curbstone on another solar wheel. So you can watch what these guys were doing. They were mapping out this solar wheel traversing this sunbeam. They were basically telling you, we know where the sunbeam's moving. This is what we're trying to do here. So yeah, I mean, the thing is, you know, it doesn't just stop at the spring and autumn equinox, Henrik, or the summer and winter solstice. Carol Keel, by the way, is famous for summer solstice sunset. Cairn G takes in the sunbeam in a special light box, very, very similar to Newgrange. I don't know of any other passage graves. I've been to 400 plus across the whole of the British Isles and Western Europe. And I've never seen another one with a light box other than Newgrange and Carol Keel, Cairn G. But also what takes in Cairn G so special is that not only on the summer solstice, the sunbeam comes in, but you have the moon comes in as well every 19 years, which is still visible today. Setting that aside, it looks like Loch Crew, these guys, and I talk about Loch Crew as the solar mapping complex because it looks like they tried to split these 4 days of the year into halves again, this solar wheel of what we call Samhain, Imbolc, Beltane and Lunasa.
Mm-hmm.
Basically the cross quarter days, these halfway points in between spring and summer, winter and the main points of the year. And the reason we'd say that is because Cairn L at Loch Crew, which is on another peak, by the way, Loch Crew is split between two peaks. It's actually over four peaks, but there's two main peaks, Cairn Bain East and Cairn Bain West. And when you go to Cairn L, there's a standing stone inside it, and the sunbeam will come in there on about the November 4th, November 5th, taking in this cross quarter day, this Samhain day. And all the other smaller cairns that are dominated around these two peaks at Loch Crew seem to take in all these special alignments, Henrik. They're taking in Inbulk, or they're taking in Beltane, or they're taking in Samhain or Lunacy, or else very, very close to it. It looks like they were trying to fine-tune their measurements. They were trying to map a, what I believe to be a solar calendar. But I also believe they were mapping a lunar calendar as well. I think these guys were attempting their calendar building stage in 3500 BC, Henrik.
3500 BC. How far back do the... You mentioned that possibly Douth and the other one is older than Newgrange. Is how well established is it with the age of these passage
That's a
graves?
Good question. Good question, Henrik. How well established is the better way to put it? Because there's various dates. I mean, they typically throw out 3000 BC as a general date.
Right.
3200 to 3000 BC. That 200-year window is the accepted. For Newgrange, they have been able to carbon date Newgrange because when they stripped the roof off it for renovation purposes and to excavate and do archaeological digs, they found a gully system like this to take the water away from the, to keep it dry inside. It was an ancient gully system. Huh. And inside the gully system, they found organic material. And of course, organic material, you can then carbon date. So they were able to carbon date it to that window at 3200 BC to 3000 BC. So yeah, Newgrange is pretty much watertight on that. Pardon the pun,
but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're still stuck in that question again.
Yeah, you know, but well, there's evidence of the Great Circle there, and then there would have been mapping before that. There's also another evidence of another henge, the exact same size of Newgrange, just outside the Newgrange stone circle, and it's marked with concrete. It's marked with concrete posts, so undoubtedly they were marking stuff out there for many centuries beforehand. If you go to Note, there's evidence there was people there 4000 BC because of the pottery and other organic material that was found there. That doesn't mean that Note was built in 4000 BC. They just know that there was people and habitation of some sort there.
Exactly, yeah.
Douth seems to be a bit more primitive in design, and they reckon that Douth could have been built first and then Newgrange and Note being more sophisticated came later. That would be a fairly good... recognition. But, I mean, when you go to Carrow Keel, it's been carbonated to 3500 BC, so it seems to be older again. Actually, Sligo seems to be the starting place for all this. There seems to be more archaeological monuments in Sligo than anywhere else. It's like there's 5,000 sites in Sligo alone. Just forget the rest of Ireland, just Sligo County and Sligo Bay around that region, 5,000 archaeological sites alone.
Wow. Why there then? Why is it... I mean, we see these kind of accumulations, if you will, in other areas of the world as well. Okay, I mean, obviously it fulfills a purpose. I mean, the people were living in the area, and that's why they did it, probably. What do you think?
Well, actually, there's another place called Carrow Moor, and I haven't mentioned that. I didn't go into that in the book because Carrow Moor, for the better part, is largely decimated. There's remains, but Carrow Moor has been dated to 5000 BC. Hmm. So have this 1500-year gap. But Carrow Moor it looks primitive. It looks even more primitive than Carrow Keel. And there's a 1,500-year gap there. I recently just shot a documentary for a Nation TV channel there because I was talking about this quartz element. And it seems to be the same style, the same pattern, the same ideology. And we're going to maybe talk a little bit about more quartz and the use of quartz at these monuments. But there's a dolmen at Carrow Keel which shows a wall of quartz. Basically, they have left the vein of quartz stuck to the wall. Basically, they have removed the granite to leave the quartz vein exposed as a sheet of quartz stuck to the side of the granite.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's extremely hard to work a stone like that just to leave the quartz exposed in a wall of quartz, basically.
Yeah.
They're basically, it looks like a slab of quartz stuck to a slab of granite. But to work the stone to do that was extremely important. These guys did this for a very specific reason. But they left it in one special location inside the dolmen so that, you know, this would take in and reflect. And, you know, you also see this at another place. I may have briefly mentioned it in the book, and I definitely go into it in my sequel, The Megalith Acoustics Mystery. But the use of quartz was also done at another one called Seafin Hill. Now, Seafin Hill is south of Dublin, and it's on the border of Dublin and Wicklow Mountains. It's on a military firing range, very difficult to get there.
And
you can only go up when the red flag's down, when it's safe to do so. Actually, the last time I was up there, I nearly got struck by lightning.
Shit, that's no good. Well, it's interesting, though, you mentioned that, because, and that's come up before, actually, that some of these sites, we have a similar one in Sweden, which is called, you know, Sweden's Stonehenge, which is Alla stenar, or Alla stones. And same thing there. The military's had a shooting range very close to this area for some interesting reason.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, I mean, and for that reason, it's also up 1,800 feet high, this one. It's something like that, or 1,600 feet high. And it's a bit of a trek up. It's across boggy land. You can't see it until you get there.
Yep.
The roof's slightly caved in, but all the wall of the passageway is covered in this quartz-like slabbed wall mechanism that these guys did. But here's the thing. It's not opening up to any equinox. It's opening up to 17 degrees east of north, this special alignment, just like Fornox. So it's bizarre, because this means it's only opening up to starlight. Yes, there would be some day of the year that the sun will enter the chamber. But, I mean, it would be very, very difficult, only in an extreme latitude. And it wouldn't enter fully into the chamber, you know, because the sun doesn't get in any more than northeast or northwest. So it's at an extremely northerly latitude, this passageway alignment. So it tells you that they were letting starlight twinkle off the quartz, which is even more mind-bending again. But, you know, so, I mean, the dating of all these, really, you just got to throw out two dates, two general dates, 5,000 BC for the really ancient stuff, and then you have 3,000 BC as a general date. But equally, I mean, they say Loch Crewe, there's evidence of three stages of building at Loch Crewe: 3,800 BC, 3,500 BC, and 3,200 BC. So like 300-year gaps. Perhaps they were refining their measurements as, because things will fall out of alignment, Henrik. This is the
60s. Exactly. You know, hundreds, I mean, people have to think about this, put this in comparison. It's like, you know, we sitting here today, and then something built during the Roman period, you know, it's like there's a long time between here, you know?
And this is the key thing. And when I go into the Newgrange Sirius mystery, this theory that Newgrange aligned to Sirius was a processional calculator. Don't forget that Sirius alignment would have been out of alignment 200 years later.
Yeah.
It could possibly be why Newgrange fell out of use. Personally, I think the alignment with Sirius is the single most biggest thing that people should be talking about. And they throw it away like it's just another alignment. I mean, mm-hmm. there's people out there, Henrik, you know, and this is the key thing. It's all to do with dating. If you can get an accurate dating on the monument, then you'll have an accurate dating on the alignment. So we have an accurate dating on the monument. That Newgrange, when it was built, was almost aligned to Sirius as well as the sun. Now, the thing is, Henrik, you can't align it to four things at the same time. You can only align it to one thing. If you get a second event, like the sun and Sirius, that's great. But I mean, yes, the moon will come in, the Venus will come in, but Venus and the moon, you got to understand that Venus and the moon, you can do any time of the year, any century, because they're moving bodies in our own solar system. But the fact that Sirius was on the same declination as the sun at the time Newgrange was built was probably one of the biggest events of the time. I mean, Sirius is a star that is, you know, the fifth brightest, it's the fifth closest star to us and one of the brightest in the night sky. You know, you got to understand that these guys worshipped Sirius, they worshipped Orion's Belt, and they worshipped the Pleiades. And all these three stellar phenomena are sitting in one line on the sky. So basically, if you look at Orion's Belt in the sky, you follow the line up, you'll hit the Pleiades, and you follow the line down, and you'll hit Sirius, the dog star, following behind Orion. Now, the key thing is, I mean, there's people think that there's alignments to Cygnus, there's alignments to Venus, and there's alignments to the moon. And sure, the moon will migrate in there at some point. And yes, Venus will also migrate in there at some point. And there's another wonderful book called Uriel's Machine. I'm not taking away from that at all. I think, yes, if there is other phenomenon like that, they're going to explore it, they're going to question it, going to think about it. But what everybody seems to ignore is that this triple spiral on the entrance stone was like the feature. It was the prize of their monument. It's the most decorated stone there. There's a central line coming down the stone saying this is the equinox. This is the winter solstice, I should say. Mm. You know, to the left of that, you have the triple spiral, which you can calculate is so many, it's 0.454 meters from the center of the stone. It's exactly 1 degree of precession. You know, you can measure the triangle. It's schoolboy mathematics, the trigonometry of this. Now, here's the thing. Nobody seems to address the trispiral being inside and being outside. And I mentioned this in the book. There's 26 interpretations for the entrance stone. Mine's just another one, okay? Mm-hmm. But mine does explain the triple spiral inside and it explains the triple spiral outside. So, I mean, the interpretations can get heavy, and they can get complicated because everybody's got their own interpretation. And when you go to Newgrange today, I don't like this, but they do kind of speak in a condescending manner to the public. And they go, everybody's right. Everybody's got their own interpretation and everybody's right. And I'm like, well, no, that's just it's not a nice way to like appeal to people. Like, you know, you're just putting people down saying that, you know. And
it's the politically correct version of
yes, exactly.
Today,
exactly.
You know, yeah.
But the key thing is, though, I mean, I think this was the single biggest, most event of the time that Newgrange and Sirius. And I think they were very aware of precession. When you look at Carol Keel, you know, I go into this, the Carol Keel Cassiopeia theory and archaeoastronomy, I'm dating it to the exact time of the carbon date. Because 3500 BC, you have a group of cairns being built that are carbon dated and... You know, the cairns B, C, E, F, and K, not very illustrious names. They're all just alphabetical names. But basically, when you look at them on the map, they're all at very specific angles. They're almost due north, but they're not. They're like 8 degrees off north, six mm-hmm. degrees north, either off northeast or off northwest. But the sun or the moon can't enter these. They can't enter these monuments because they're lying too far north. The sun doesn't get any more than northeast or northwest or southeast or southwest in the winter. So, you know, it's basically telling us these are aligned to stars. There is nothing else that can get in there. You know, this is the beauty of Carol Keel. And Carol Keel is basically, just for the listeners, it's in its own gated complex. It looks pretty much as it did at the time it was first erected. I mean, there's no habitation nearby. There's just sheep grazing there. Mm. They're sitting up at about 1,000 feet high. Apart from the bog that's growing there, I mean, it probably looked like all limestone at one stage, but there's bogland growing on top of the limestone now. So apart from the bogland that's growing there, I mean, it looks pretty much as it did. I mean, you know, it's pretty much unscathed. There has been one semi-professional excavation done there in 1910, but setting that aside, I mean, there's been very little interference there. You know,
speaking about that, let me ask you though before we move on there. Newgrange, there of course, this has been restored. It's been excavated. It's been questioned whether even the you know the white stone that we see on the side and the front, I should say, if that was there in the beginning. How much do you think has been redone on the monument, and how did it actually look from the beginning?
Thank you for mentioning that, Henrik, because it's an ugly 1960s reconstruction. Basically, that's putting it. That's me putting it nicely. I think it's abhorrent. I think it's disgusting, Harry. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He did that. But I have to understand also that this was the 1960s. I think they thought they were doing good. You know, they get so much bad press, even by myself. But, you know, but I mean, you know, inside, it's beautiful. Inside, it's pristine. Inside, it's pretty much as it was, Henrik. It's an awe-inspiring monument on the inside. Forget what it looks like on the outside. It's held up by a concrete wall, Henrik. I think it was more like, and pretty much people accept this, that it was more like a truncated cone, that this was a conical pyramidic type monument. It's slightly flattened dome at the moment because of the slippage over the years, the settlement and slippage. But it was pretty much like a cone-shaped monument topped with white quartz. That's probably what the white quartz was doing there.
Because they used the stone that was there, right, that, to make the wall. But
yes, but
configuration.
Yeah, they used it in their own rendition, their own configuration. But on the quartz comes from 60 kilometers away, Henrik.
That's right. Yeah,
and that actually comes from the Siphon Hill Mountains where I mentioned. And you can, there is other passage graves. I mean, you got to understand that they also built passage graves. There's one in Armagh, County Armagh in Northern Ireland, not too far from where I'm living now. It's the tallest passage grave in Ireland. You can see one third of Ireland from that passage grave.
Wow.
You can see something. And when you're in Lough Crew, you can see a half of Ireland. You can see 18 different counties from Lough Crew because it's on top of quite a large hill and it's low-lying plains below it. But when you're in Armagh, which is just on the border of Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, you can see the Wicklow Hills, where the quartz comes from. You can actually see 60 miles to the south. Like,
wow.
So, I mean, people think, they dragged all this quartz from here and they brought it this long distance. They could see that distance, you know. They could see where they were bringing these stuff from. And they shipped this quartz in. It was a pretty valuable commodity to be shipping it 60 kilometers, 40 miles to the Newgrange. To ship it that distance, Henrik, it was a very important commodity to these guys.
Yeah.
You know, that's the first thing we should say. And it wasn't the only commodity. I mean, they shipped the cobblestones from 40 kilometers to the north in the Cooley Peninsula. And they brought the grey wacky 6 kilometers. These are the curbstones, these big giant curbstones, maybe a couple of 2.5 meters long. They brought that from the nearest quarry, which was 6 miles, or about 6 kilometers. So, I mean, they were quarrying materials from north, south, east, and west to bring to Newgrange. So it tells you that the location was important. The location is what they wanted, and they brought the materials to the location. That's what you got to understand. It wasn't, otherwise you would have built it at the location of the materials, and
right,
you wouldn't have to carry it.
That's right.
But I mean, they did have Siphon Hill there already. So, you know, it seems to be, and I don't normally concentrate, Henrik, on the burial function. Now, let's just say they're called passage graves because there's a passageway going into the internal mound with the central chamber, and there's bodies, cremations of bodies found inside. When you've stood in all the places that I've stood at, Henrik, and I've stood in like Carroll Keel, Carroll Moor, Armagh, Siphon Hill, Seahan Hill, Balting Glass Hill in Wicklow, and you've stood in all these places and you realize that these very high passage graves, you can see the other passage grave in the distance, and you can see from there, you can see the other one in the distance. If you think about a funeral pyre, when you had to cremate a body, you would have seen that funeral pyre because it takes an awful lot of trees and an awful lot of heat to burn a body. So they cremated the bodies outside and brought the remains inside. And they scattered the remains of the dead. Now, perhaps they only buried the astronomer priests inside and not everybody in the village community. But you would have seen the funeral pyres burning. And so these were very much a cultural function. It was a network of passage graves. There was like clusters of them, yes. There was clusters in Newgrange and Note and Dose. And then there was clusters of them in Carroll Keel and clusters from Carroll Moor. But they're all visible from each other, especially when you go to Sligo. It's so disorientating to stand on every hill, and every time you stand on a hill, you see another passage grave. Huh. It's quite literally. There's one of them, Queen Maeve's Cairn, you can see 20 miles away, dominating on the landscape.
Mm.
You know, so the point is, you it's a cultural function, you know, to these as well. Like, I mean, I don't normally concentrate on the burial chamber because that's what the archaeologists do.
Sure.
And they do a grave disservice to that. That's the only thing they want to look at, but. You know, they're astronomical observatories. They're equally a cultural function with the burial and the respect for the dead as well.
So many more components to this, of course, of where we could go with this. But one thing I want to get into more is the rock art. We obviously want to talk more about the, you know, detailing the more on the spirals and what this means, the serious connection, how you kind of came to these conclusions. But is there anything more you want to say about the, you know, the physicality, I guess we can say, about the monuments? Again, maybe something else on the quartz stone, the choice of this, the reasoning behind that. What do you think?
Wow. Well, actually, I'm in collaboration with Maurice Cotterell now and again, and Maurice has given me some information. I feel very privileged, and I thank Maurice Cotterell for it, because my sequel, The Megalith Acoustics Mystery, would not be the book that it is without Maurice Cotterell enlightening me to knowledge. I love Maurice Cotterell's work. I grew up on Maurice Cotterell.
Yeah, he has some great stuff, yeah.
Yeah, he's an awesome guy, a very nice, beautiful man. Like, you know, he's got a great philosophy of this world, and he basically enlightened me to a book called Mind, Body and Electromagnetism by John Evans. And really, that was the key thing for me. And I'm now beginning to, this ties in with the quartz as well. I think the quartz was the fertility element. I overlooked the fertility element, the first book I wrote. And I had done research for my acoustics book at the same time as the astronomy book. And I was going to leave it at that. I was just going to leave it as the first book was astronomy and the second book was acoustics, because equally, they are astronomical observatories using observational cosmology to figure out the heavens. And equally inside, there's an acoustics element that can't be ignored. It doesn't go away. It's linked with the multi-megaliths, the hypogeum, the megalithic temples all around Britain and Ireland. They all have this common thread of acoustics knowledge. And the art backs that up too, Henrik, which we'll get in. But the key thing is that I overlooked this fertility element, and I just... You know, I had enough on my plate, in fairness. Like, you know, it's like I didn't think there was anything to figure out. And what Maurice told me was, you know, because I was discussing the work of Michael Ponder, and I didn't know at the time, because somebody had given me Michael Ponder's book called Pie in the Sky, and he'd gone into a lot of the elements of the quartz and what that really means. But Maurice said that he had actually given the information to Michael Ponder. So I was there, found myself discussing this with Maurice. But basically, electromagnetic light, the sun beam coming in is electromagnetic light. And that electromagnetic light is two components, electric and magnetic. One wave goes up and down and the other one goes left and right. And they're 90 degrees from each other. But the thing is, when electromagnetic light hits quartz, it becomes more magnetic. It gets shifted into the magnetic because the way it reflects off the quartz. And being more magnetic, that will enhance the production of melatonin, which is also enhances fertility. So did these guys know this to that detail? I don't know. I don't think so. But, you know, I'm open to these guys being super scientists now. These guys have a super philosophy, Henrik. But the thing is, maybe they just knew in a holistic way that quartz helped fertility. Maybe they liked the quartz. Maybe they appreciated the sparkling effect of the quartz. Maybe they said, this looks pretty. It doesn't really matter how they discovered this, but that the use of quartz, perhaps, you know, maybe this is why they have the quartz lined passageways. I've come to believe basically that, you know, when you look at the consciousness that was explored inside these monuments with the acoustics, and when you look at the astronomy and this mindset that they were trying to develop, and when you look at the fertility, because there's fertility rites with the Maltese megaliths, there's fertility rites at notes, there's phallic symbols everywhere. You know, the fertility thing doesn't go away.
Right, yeah.
I think basically these guys were conceived there. I think they explored their consciousness there. And when they died and departed this world, they were buried there. You know, this was like a start, middle and end story.
Well, I've always seen, sorry to interrupt, James, but I've always kind of seen that the sun, you know, I have to use the term, penetrates into the inner chamber. So kind of a seeding process almost, you know, so it's very symbolic and rich in that context.
Exactly. And the thing is, I'm glad you brought that up, because Newgrange is in the shape of a womb. When you look down at it from above, and by the way, on my book page, Newgrange Cosmology, I have a little Google Earth megaliths video of the passage graves of Ireland. So people can actually just see what these places look like from
nice.
Google Earth.
Right.
Yeah, and it's to help people kind of understand, because not everybody was going to go and look up all these individual images, and it's nice to have them in the one locale. So that's why I did that. But when you look at Newgrange from the air, it looks like the shape of a womb. And when you think about what you just described, Henrik, that the sun dagger penetrating the womb, it's another fertility angle. It's a very symbolic event, basically. It's not just the sunbeam lighting up the internal passageway and having a nice phenomena. It's a bit more than that, you know. And, you know, Newgrange is known as the place of the white cow. You know, that's what it basically translates as. You know, it's again, the cow was a symbol of fertility. It was a deity that was worshipped. also with the Dogon too, which we're going to get into, and the Dogon art. But I mean, for me, the art is the key, Henrik. The art is the key to all this. The astronomy art, you know, people don't wrestle with that so much. That people pretty much accept that. You know, when you explain that there's so many lunar counts here, and this is at the same side as the mound as they were calculating lunar calculations, it's pretty acceptable. You know, there's a bit of mentality involved. There's a bit of a line of thought. You know, a lot of the carvings and the stonework then basically reflect some fertility. And I mean, when you look at Loch Crew from a distance, it looks like two bosoms, the two breasts on the hill, and the little cairn sitting on top of the hill basically looks like the nipple of the breast. And there's this motherly function to this nurturing these two breasts, as does Queen Maeve's cairn in Sligo sitting on top of the hill, Knocknaree Mountain. So yeah, it looks to be these light show chosen to mimic fertility or nurturing concepts. Well, yeah, I mean, for me, some of the most important stuff is the art. The astronomy is what brought me into this. This extra stuff is, you know, is a line of evidence that I've gone down. And I say, when the acoustics art is just as equally as astounding as the astronomy art. It's a little bit more in-depth. There's a little bit more acceptance needed. Let's say that. I mean, and what I mean, basically, I got drawn to the acoustics art and the acoustics angle through Graham Hancock's work, Supernatural. And in Graham's work, Supernatural, he talks about entoptic phenomena. And the entoptic phenomena is basically the imagery that you see while you go into an altered state of consciousness. And when you do, you would see things like floating circles, spirals, like I said, zigzag wavy lines, you know, concentric circles, semicircles, and all these entoptic.
That's full. That's what you're talking about. When you're talking about the rock art in Ireland, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And when I read, this is the thing, exactly, Henrik, when I read Supernatural, I was gobsmacked. I went, oh my God, that's New Grange art. I just made the assimilation straight in my head. And the more I looked at the chart of entoptic imagery, there's a chart in the book. I went, oh my God, there's like so many pieces of Newgrange, just like horseshoe shapes. And I'm like, all I could see was Newgrange art and Noth art. And I went, oh, this is consciousness art, basically. Now, it's not the only example of it. I mean, the Sandrock art in South Africa is mimics this as well. So as does the some of the Lascaux and Peshmerga cave paintings in France going back thousands of years. So were these guys drawing consciousness art as well as the astronomy? Yes, I think so. I mean, I have no reason not to believe it. Naively, I thought when I wrote the Megalith Acoustics Mystery that I would prove whether it was going to be acoustics was the mechanism to get these guys to explore their consciousness, or was it going to be a psychedelic? A lot of people have hypothesized, Henrik, that psychedelics was the compound or the mechanism used to explore their consciousness, and that's where they got the images from. Mm-hmm. Now, I kind of first heard about that many years ago at a Newgrange visit, because they sometimes talk about this on the visits, then they throw it out there. And there seems to be more evidence for the acoustics angle, because acoustics can affect the consciousness, and something like theta frequencies are inherent inside these monuments. 7 hertz. If you beat a drum 5 to 7 times a second, and you can sustain it long enough. And I did this recently with Gary Evans, and I felt my mind was just like jelly when I came out. quite literally, it's a daunting effect.
Place, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Like a hypnotic effect on the brain. And, you know, so not just that, there's infrasound as well, and they also resonate at the male vocal range. It's a complex acoustic map inside these monuments. But the key thing is, I mean, acoustics is another route into the consciousness art. I now believe, after finishing my megalithic research, that, you know, acoustics was the reason I wrote about the acoustics mystery. You know, it was the reason that I was studying it. It was the reason that I wanted to understand this consciousness art. But I equally think that the psychedelic compounds were used alongside the acoustics. I think it's a more complex story, Henrik.
So let's talk a little bit more about the three spirals that we find on some of the stones, and then also inside of the chamber, and what you think that means, basically.
Yes. Okay. So let's just say that the The reason I think there's a Dogon link is because of the spiral, but it's not just the spiral. There's the concentric circle. There's the glyph with the triple water wave. It's inherent at Loch Crewe and the Newgrange as well. There's the solar wheel, which is basically a circle with eight segments in it. There's also another thing that Dogon use as well, which is this leaf. It looks like a leaf with a vein on it and then lines coming off the vein, what you would draw like a leaf, basically. And these are all images. There's like five of these images. There's the spiral, the concentric circles, the triple water wave, the solar wheel, and this leaf. And these are all used by the Dogon, first and foremost. And I have been aware of this. And again, I'm like, you know, getting pulled in many directions, Henrik. What I didn't realize at the time was that, like, there is some sort of a Dogon influence. I come across the work of Laird Scranton, who I know you've had on the show, and he's an awesome, prolific researcher. And
yeah,
I kind of synchronize with what Laird brings to the table, because, again, I'm a systems analyst. I look at complexity and I look at programs. And, you know, Laird is a computer programmer, and he looks at computer languages and language systems, like, so, and imagery. I can understand why he brings something different to the table. And, you know, I pretty much accept my philosophy now that the Dogon have marched out of ancient Egypt. I mean, if you follow the work of Laird, it's a bit of a no-brainer. There's so many points of commonality with the Dogon marching out of ancient Egypt. And I like to think that, you know, when they marched around the top of North Africa, they may have went in another direction. They may have had an influence with the megalithic chambers, because don't forget, it's not just in Ireland and Britain. I mean, they marched across the top of North Africa, which is basically across from the Straits of Gibraltar, across from southwestern Europe. And there's passage graves there in Alkalar showing, again, the pottery showing similarities with Scottish rock art at Scarabray. And you've got the Malta megaliths, the solar wheel is inherent there. And the key thing is, and I'm going to try and tie this in with the spiral and what I call the Dogon sun wheel, this solar wheel, is that these two symbols are very, very significant to the Dogon, but very, very significant to the megalithic rock art of Ireland. Now, the spiral, it pops up everywhere, and you might just think that that's a bit of a coincidence, but it doesn't stop there. This solar wheel was used by the Egyptians. It was used by the Dogon, and it was used by the megalithic builders to simulate heliacal rising. And just to explain that for the listeners, Henrik, the heliacal rising is basically helios meaning the sun, and rising basically was when the sun rises and drowns out a star or a constellation very, very quickly. So sunrise is just about to happen. You're looking at the Pleiades or Orion or Sirius, and it gets drowned out very quickly.
Right.
That was very, very important to the ancient Egyptians. They were obsessed with heliacal risings. And when you had a heliacal rising of something like Sirius, which they worshipped, or Orion, that was like the golden prize. And when you had a heliacal rising on an equinox or a solstice, that was just mind-blowing to these guys. This is what they were all about. Because when you see a heliacal rising, not only are you looking at it on an equinox, this is the key thing, Henrik, not only are you looking at the heliacal rising on an equinox, because an equinox happens at the same day, give or take, over the centuries, every year. It might fluctuate by a day or so, but it's the same time of day. And don't forget, when you're looking at the same day every year, Henrik, you're looking at winter constellations, summer constellations, spring constellations, because the constellations change over the year. But if you're looking at the winter solstice every year, you're looking when all the conditions are the exact same. But not only that, if you're looking at a heliacal rising, you're looking at the exact same time of day on the same day every year. Mm-hmm. It was just like a Swiss clock digital precision, like, you know, because if you're looking at a heliacal rising, you're going to figure out something happening. You're looking at a deeper cycle within a cycle within a cycle. You know, the question is then, were these guys aware of all this? And this is where it ties in with the triple spiral and the Pleiades stone as well at Doth, because it looks like they were trying these heliacal risings of constellations, you know, on these special days, because the heliacal rising of the Pleiades occurs at Doth, which I wrote about in the book. And it also faces the Pleiades rock art, Kerbstone 51 at Doth. It faces its own image of the Pleiades at the time that Doth was built, on a very special day, on an equinox, as does the triple spiral. The triple spiral faces Sirius on the winter solstice when it's aligned to. Now, the sunbeam comes in every year. It's entering the passageway. It's a very, very accurate monument. Let's just say that, you know, the sunbeam does penetrate 19 meters. That's some 60 feet, you know, to get the sunbeam to enter that full distance, that deep into the monument is an extreme feat of engineering, Henrik.
Mm.
Very, very extreme feat of engineering to get that accuracy. Yeah. You know, it's not that you could take you 50 years to map that out just alone before you even build anything, before you put your hand to stone. It'll take you 50 years to maybe plan that out. And yeah, and as well as that, you're at the mercy of the weather.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, so then to get serious doing something very, very funny like this, almost the same declination as the sun, they knew that. I mean, they were looking at the sky for 50 years to map out the sun. Like, I mean, they knew that 12 hours later on the same day, oh, hey, Sirius is almost there. I mean, they're looking at the same point on the horizon for 50 years. Like, you know, these guys knew that Sirius was there. They're going, well, maybe let's try and figure out and write this in stone. But if you think about it, if the sun enters the passageway and at the exact center of the entrance stone, and Sirius is just to the right of it, and I mark that with the triple spiral, which is what I believe, they mark this with the triple spiral. Well, eventually precession of the equinox will knock this alignment out. And what happens is it will migrate into the chamber. Eventually, it will do the exact same thing as the sun. And then it will migrate out of the chamber and it'll be out of alignment again. Eventually it will rise in the horizon that it won't enter the chamber at all. But I think they marked the events, Henrik, and I think they marked it with the triple spiral, which is why you see the triple spiral inside and the triple spiral outside. Now, maybe I like to think that they didn't just mark the event and go, that was a nice phenomena. Hey, we were lucky with that. I think it was more than that. I think they tried to calculate the rate of precession. I think they may have done it crudely. I think they could have basically said, well, how many winter solstices is it going to be before it enters the chamber to go this distance? Maybe as simple, as crude as that. I mean, it didn't have to be angles and measurements to them. It could be just simply the Sirius rises on the horizon, hits the triple spiral of the entrance stone, and then it's so many winter solstices until it hits the center of the back chamber. And I think that's what they did, Henrik. There's evidence to think then as well that they did it at the Pleiades stone on Dote as well, because, you know, it's just sitting there. It's knocked out of alignment. It's knocked out of alignment after, what, 200 years? 200 years, it's going to be the width of the moon out of alignment, basically. Mm-hmm. So 1 degree, mm-hmm. 1 degree every 72 years is the rate of precession. And that's a human lifetime that people that kind of understand that and grasp that a bit better. But yeah, I mean, the spiral and the sun wheel, you know, these are incredibly important. It was the same ideology that the Dogon used. It's the same ideology that the Egyptians used. It's the same ideology. It's not just a symbol doing something similar. It's the exact symbol doing the exact same thing, a very specific concept in all locations. That's the key thing here, Henry.
Now, before we take a break here in a little bit, let's try to get a little closer to why also Sirius was important, continue to kind of clarify why some of the sites, you know, in the sky and the heavens were important markers. And if you believe, James, that this basically follows on from the Dogon mythology and, you know, an extension to that, and we'll see if we get into that more detail in the second hour, the second part of it, which is, of course, you know, who the builders were, where they came from, and if there was if these were migrants or whatever. But let's try to tackle that first part. Why was Sirius so important, do you think?
Well, you know, first of all, when we talk about the Dogon talk about Sirius and their, you know, teachers, the Numo, who were semi-aquatic fish gods, and most people kind of, you know, they struggle with that. They don't want to accept that. They don't want to talk about it. It's the pink elephant in the room. They don't want to deal with it. And that's, you know, I don't really go into that too much. That doesn't bother me because that doesn't really affect the astronomy. The astronomy is there. The Sirius is there. The spiral is there. But I do think that if Sirius, I mean, there's other alternatives to my theory. Like, you know, there's people think that we orbit Sirius. And I think it's just a bit preposterous, to be honest with you. It's far too much. If we did orbit Sirius, by the way, it would be like the biggest discovery since gravity, like, because, I mean, we'd have to overcome gravity for that to happen. I think we might orbit another dark failed star, and that, you know, we might gravitate towards Sirius, but I think, you know, it's five stars away from us. There's four other stars there that are more important that would affect us. Like, you know, if we're going to orbit them, you know, we're going to orbit them first, like, you know. But I think the point is, though, that the Nummo, if we did orbit Sirius, I think we would know about it because they told the Dogon everything about Sirius. I think they would have told us that we orbit Sirius as well. So let me just say that first and foremost. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I think the ideology and the knowledge of Sirius is inherent in all ancient cultures. They were worshipped it and were obsessed about it. You know, did we come from Sirius? Did we come from the Pleiades? Was there did our originators come from there? Like, perhaps I'm open to that, Henrik. I'm totally open to that. You know, it's a philosophy that is really becoming backed up with science now. And, you know, it's just so uncanny that what the Dogon tell us about Sirius, that it's a binary system. It's actually a triple system, but it's predominantly a binary system. But they know it's a triple system. But they talk about this the two parent stars, the binary system being orbiting in 50 years that they have accurately. You know, they talk about the second one, Sirius B, being heavy and white, like a white dwarf, you know. But they also talk about the Pleiades as well. And the Pleiades and Sirius were incredibly important to these guys, you know, and it lasts through mythology through the world ages. I mean, but, you know, they're not the only ancient culture, Dogon or Egypt. Like, I mean, you even had Stephen Strong on. He contacted me long after your own show about the Pleiades in Australia as well and the mythology there. And, you know, it's bizarre, like, that everywhere you look around this globe, Henrik, this Pleiades is popping up, as is Sirius, like.
Sure, yeah.
So celestial lore, basically, if you want to call it that, Henrik, that the celestial lore of the Pleiades and Sirius is so important to all ancient cultures. You know, is there some sort of a link for precession? Does it affect our precession? That's the big question. I don't think Sirius affects our precession. I think it might affect our consciousness. I think that's definitely a thing. I think, you know, there are a lot of unanswered questions that most mainstream scientists don't want to deal with. But, you know, there is alternative research out there pointing in this direction now and pointing at some sort of answers or some sort of direction of answers that are evolving. And we're kind of getting towards some truth. Maybe we have a long way to go yet, Henry. But, you know, I think the spiral and the Dogon and the sun wheel and the triple water wave. And ironically, when you look at Lars Granton's work in the triple water wave, that he associates this as matter and waves. You know, this is what the Dogon associated as matter and waves. And when you look at Gavrinus, Passage Grave, in France, in Brittany, again, it's showing acoustic waves in coalescing with each other in constructive and destructive interference, like, you know.
Exactly. That's what's striking to me. It shows like interference patterns, basically, from, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. This is like if schoolboy physics. I'm a physics with astronomy degree, and matter and waves is something, a core body of my research. And it's an academic degree I never used, Henrik. But the point is, you know, I understand it, and I just see the acoustic map. It's an acoustic map of constructive and destructive interference. But unless you've studied that, you won't see it to that detail, or you won't immediately recognize it, I should say.
Yeah.
But it is schoolboy physics. It's not hard to get your head around. Anybody can do it. Look up constructive and destructive interference patterns, and then look at the acoustics, what I call the acoustics art of Gavrinus. A lot of people think they were drawing water waves, and that's their easy way to get around. That's the easy way to get around this, Henrik, so they don't have to raise these ancient guys up to highly advanced, like, you know, because a lot of archaeologists want to keep them in the dark. They want to keep them as dummies. They keep them suppressed. They keep them as savages or primitive or, you know, but the more I look into this, Henrik, and naively I thought I would just do a book on astronomy, and naively then I thought I would just do the sequel on the acoustics. But I am, as a highly educated person, having to raise my awareness up and my perception of these guys as super scientists, as like super advanced, highly conscious beings. Like, I've no choice but to do it.
Well, it's very interesting. We're going to talk more about this in the second hour, of course. And before we talk more about your websites and give out some of the details, James, I just want to mention as well, I think that there is a multiple contextual communication, for the lack of a better term, happening at the same time. I think that at the same time as the deeper processes of, you know, the fabric of reality, if you will, could be interpreted in some of the art that we're seeing, it could very well also speak about the journey that they've made. It's, I mean, everything has this kind of holographic context to it. And so whatever you're, you know, attempting to describe, there's going to be a higher and a lower meaning to that. And that's what I think is so, you know, fantastic when you look at some of the art, that you can literally look at it and find your interpretation, but it doesn't rule out, you know, the other possibilities either. It's very interesting. But why don't we talk a little bit more about where people can pick up copies of your book, James? I mean, it's called The Newgrange Serious Mystery, and the subtitle is Linking Passage Grave Cosmology with Dogon Symbolism. So let's give out some of the websites and stuff. And I also know that you want to mention some of your upcoming events, James. So please go ahead.
Sure, yes. My author's page, and I basically host everything that I do on this one page. It's called jamesswagger.com. That's two G's for my surname, jamesswagger.com. And you can find the webpage for the book, newgrangecosmology.com, which I try to keep updated as much as I can. It's a work in progress. And please, if you got any questions, submit to me via either site. You'll find me in jamesswagger.com or newgrangecosmology.com. I'd love to hear from you. Any ideas, any philosophies, I'm open to all suggestions at this stage. Because like you said, Henrik, this is a multitude of contextual information at these sites. Like there's a whole, so much going on at these. I'm open to interpretation on pretty much everything, like, you know. And and I have a very busy year coming up next year, Henrik, just between conferences and tours that I'm doing. I'm doing a Stonehenge conference for Freedom for Stonehenge. The Druids are looking to get some rights back that have been taken off them by Stonehenge. And there's a conference for this. Michael Tellinger will be speaking at that, as will I. Possibly a UFO paranormal conference at the same venue at Bodenham Manor. And that's in Hereford. And you'll find that on jamesswagger.com tours. If you go to jamesswagger.com, you'll find the links there. And I'm doing some pretty big tours next year. I'm doing Brittany and Jersey together to do a megaliths tour there. I'm doing the Ohio Mounds with Fritz Zimmerman, Serpent Mound in Ohio, and all the other mounds. And it's a place that has long held my interest. Totally fascinating, Henrik. Serpent Mound in Ohio. That's, again, all these tours will be on jamesswagger.com. I'm doing an Equinox tour for Malta. Can't wait to go back there. I was there last year for the Equinox. You get to watch the sunrise event for the Equinox at the Maltese megaliths. And hopefully all being well, a Peru tour. I'm definitely going to be going with Santa Spinacci to Peru on a journey just to gather the two of us, but we might turn it into a tour. We haven't decided yet. That's unwritten as we speak, but all being well, I can turn that into a tour, but we're not too sure about that yet. Oh, yes, and I mentioned my good friend Gary Evans, the Irish tour I should be mentioning first and foremost. I'll be doing an Irish tour with Gary Evans. I'm going to be his man on the ground here with the local information. And, you know, I love what Gary does, Infinite Connections. You know, he brings a different tour to the table. I'm just honored to be a part of it. He explores spirituality, consciousness, and he tries to reconnect to sources of ancient sites. And, you know, we just had a tour together, you know, this year, as I did with Santa Spinacci. And it was great to have these two guys back to back a week after each other, an overlap of 2 days to do some experiments with drumming. Santa's playing flamenco guitar inside the ancient monuments and checking out the chords that resonate inside the chambers and stuff. But these are awesome monuments. And, you know, if you're not coming on a tour with me, you should check these out on other tours. There's many out there. You know, just get out there and see some of these ancient monuments. That's why I do the tours. I try to bring something different to the table, Henrik. And, you know, I've got a very busy year next year. I can't believe I'm taking out on so much so soon. I'm planning out next year's events. But of course, everything's at jamesswagger.com. You can check out my own podcast for some shows I do there. And, you know, it's like something I'm very, very passionate about, Henrik. This is an exploration of knowledge to me, first and foremost. I want to bring something different to the table. I want to address the questions of these ancient monuments. You know, and I'm doing this from many angles. I'm talking to people at conferences. I'm talking to people on radio. I'm talking to people, you know, on tours, you know, and the people are just as important as me, Henrik. These are the people that maybe twig some piece of information that I haven't seen before and haven't looked at. I was recently on a tour with somebody who visited, an American lady, and she pointed out the triangular stones to me that, you know, at Loch Crew. This triangular stone, and it's only at the second visit I went back that Karen D they excavated Cairn D and they gave up and basically put a big hole in the side of it and couldn't find the chamber. And I've just spotted that there's two triangular stones diagrammatically opposite each other. And on one side, it's beside a fallen quartz pillar. And I really do believe now that that's where the entrance is at. They just dug at the wrong side. And, you know, so that's going to be in my guidebook, my Loch Crew guidebook. I've got three guidebooks coming up by the end of the year. They'll all be released at the same time. And there'll be a webpage. I usually do a webpage for every book, so not to confuse everybody with my websites, but I do host them all on jamesswagger.com. So that's my shameless plugins done.
Very good. Well, it's good because a lot of people want to know where to find more information about this and also, of course, know about your upcoming events. So we'll link to the website you mentioned and foremost then jamesswagger.com. Go there to check that out. And then also newgrangecosmology.com. And that's where you can pick up copies of the Newgrange Serious Mystery and heads up on that new upcoming one. But all right, stay with us, James. We'll take a short break here. We'll be right back with more in a little bit. As we proceed in the second hour, we'll talk more about megalithic acoustics or archaeoacoustics. And I think even perhaps more interestingly, James profiles the builders, who they were and what their intentions were. We talk about Porcupine Bank, this sunken piece of land to the west of Ireland, and the possibility that this was High Brasil, the mythical island. So the question is if this was the origin of the builders. We'll also discuss worldwide catastrophe many thousands of years ago, spawning the building of many of these monuments and ritual halls. We also talk about cup and ring marks and much more, of course, on the rock art found all over the world. You can continue to listen to the second hour at redicemembers.com. You can sign up for a membership and stream or download all of our programs, videos and films and everything we have on there. We have RSS feeds and instructions on how to hook up our feed to your computer or portable devices and get the program directly right to you. But before we proceed then in the second hour, some of our upcoming guests include Ingrid Karlqvist from Dispatch International about the mass immigration into Sweden and the consequent problems with that. We also have booked Steve Gorham, Jason Erb, and Jesse Ventura. Please continue to listen at redicemembers.com. Much more coming for members right after the break. Thank you for listening.